Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Hey folks, well here we are with another of our amazing guests from the other side of the world. I seem to be racking up our American guests at the moment, and today another guest that I've been chasing for an awful long time. I met him several years ago when he came to Yorkshire. He's one of the world's foremost kettlebell experts, among other things. It's Mr. Steve Cotter. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks a lot, Simon. Nice to connect with you again.
Well, it's been a while, and I mentioned there that I've been chasing you for quite some time. You've been doing an awful lot of traveling recently, and it's taken us a while to fix this date.
Yes, if recently means the last 12 years, then you're correct. I have been.
I was trying to think about when it was that you came to Yorkshire to do the kettlebell workshop that we attended. Do you remember? I've got a feeling it was...
So at Allen Orr, yes?
Possibly, yeah.
Are you speaking about Harrogate? Was it Harrogate?
Yeah, that's okay. The one, yeah.
So there was also Simon who owned the school.
Mm.
That would have been 2009.
Wow. So yeah. Time flies then, doesn't it?
And then maybe once again, 2011 or 2012.
Okay, well, we're going to get on to your kettlebell work in a moment, Steve. But as we're both coaches and we both understand the value of warming up before we get into the main set, so I have a little warm-up quiz for you. I did tee you up with some of these questions. So you clearly enjoy the work you do, Steve. But if you weren't able to do that, what would your dream job be?
Actually, writing.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm a eternal student. I like to read. We can call that research. It's research for life. And so, yeah, the job that doesn't require me to have to go anywhere or answer to anybody, that'd be the job for me.
And any particular style and type of writing then that you like to do?
Not really. I think that, streams of consciousness is really what most interesting to me. So it's, you know, it's something to transition to. It's not something where I am right now, but you did say dream job.
Of course. Yeah. You mentioned about streams of consciousness and forever learning. Do you do anything like keep a gratitude diary and write every day?
I don't write every day. Although when I'm commissioned to write something, it's a good idea to do that. I'm more of a fire, you know, creative, like let's just bang it out in one or two days type of person. But as far as gratitude, that's something I include in my meditations daily.
Mm. Oh, that's something we could talk about, meditation. I've been talking with a lot of people about that recently as a way of helping your body to get a bit of balance to the constant sort of go, 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 and also for mental health as well.
Everything is mind. And so, you know, directing the consciousness and the process of that is probably our greatest value for time activity that we can possibly do, you know, other than breathing itself, which is meditation.
Yeah, and again, I think a lot of people take breathing for granted. I mean, let's face it, you and I we've got to a reasonable stage in our life, and if we weren't reasonably good at breathing, we wouldn't still be here. But equally so,
survivors.
Most people aren't actually breathing correctly, are they? And I suppose that could be another podcast in itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, breathing, moving, it's all connected. And yes, most of our fellow humans are in a bad state when it comes to looking after their physical well-being, which has to start with breathing and also has to include movement.
Yeah, breathing, movement, and sleep. Sleep's the other one there that I think we're not particularly good at as humans.
The recuperation, yes, the regeneration component. And, you know, potentially the more meditation can equal less sleep. So it's not the sleep itself so much as it is the downloading. And so that's usually what we turn to sleep to get that, because out of that 8 or 9 hours or whatever it is, you might get a good 45 minutes or an hour or something of actual recuperation. So if you were able to train yourself to the point that you can immediately go into the, you know, and that's what someone that is, would be truly a meditation master, they have that kind of capacity to where it's okay, I'm only sleeping an hour or two, or, you know, maybe not sleeping at all because I don't need to, right? So I'm not at that level, but it is achievable.
How long do you meditate for each day, assuming you do meditate each day?
Currently, I do a 20-minute, about 18 and a half to 20, 19 minutes. I practice a six-phase meditation, which is a real nice, there's an app for it. It's on YouTube. I met the originator of that is a guy named Vishen Lakhani, who's a best-selling author. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a good app because it combines the ancient wisdom with sort of technological understanding. And, you know, you speak about gratitude, that's a component, you know, forgiveness is a component, you know, future thinking is a component, your daily sort of perfect day is a component. Love, of course, is the foundational component. So it's about just, you know, so I like it. It's something that's very useful for a busy person in, you know, the 21st century that maybe isn't going to sit in a full lotus position, you know, and meditate for an hour, but can get the same benefits, you know. So that's a great. And then out of the practice, but quite often, and I put some time into doing sort of my own variation where I've combined Wim Hof breathing methods.
Oh yeah, yeah.
With some metronome, with, you know, kind of theta state, you know. So I've kind of made some blends that I like to do. It's not my daily practice at the moment. So as far as the daily practice, the six phase is something, because it's, you know, again, it's about 19 minutes and it covers all the bases.
Is that something you do at a specific time of day, or does that change depending on your schedule?
Yeah, I'm not so regimented as far as specific time. The thing about it is you have an app, it's on your phone, and, you know, that makes it a lot more accessible.
Do you recall the name of the app?
Yeah, Six Phase Meditation.
Okay.
The app is Omvana, Omvana. But you can also find Six Phase Meditation on YouTube and download it from there.
Okay, well, we'll make a note of that. I use the Headspace app at the moment, 10 minutes a day.
I went through the whole Headspace a few years ago. I did that, you know, every day until... It's a good entry. It's a good boot. Actually, that was, I know a Buddhist, he's a Geelong, he's a Buddhist monk. And, it's a friend of mine who I had the occasion to meet some years back. And, he actually mentioned that Headspace is kind of a good entry. It kind of has a basic Buddhist component. And I like it, you know, and it got to a point with that where, okay, I need to kind of look and go a little further with this. So I like that app. And I think if you like Headspace, you'll really like this as well.
Do you, you mentioned Wim Hof there. I've been reading The Way of the Iceman and a couple of his books. Do you follow any of his other practices? Do you do daily cold water immersion at all?
Yes, not the immersion, but the shower. The shower, yeah, is my daily, yeah.
How long do you do? I do 2 minutes in the cold shower at the moment. It's about enough, you know, to me.
I actually went all the way through his program. I had a chance to meet also Wim Hof. And, you know, this the sort of circles within circles. The app that I mentioned to you, the six-phase meditation, the founder of that, the creator of that app is a founder of a company called Mind Valley. And they're currently the world's largest what's called personal growth, you know, personal growth industry in terms of the 20 years ago, that was, you know, 10 years ago, that was still called self-help. Now it's called personal growth, right? So that's sort of, you know, and now we've emerged into, it's not just books, it's the whole technological. So you have the online, you know, and they do that better than anyone. And Mindvalley sort of has this curation of thought leaders, you know, and I've been able to interact with Mindvalley and go to some of their events. And this is where I'm meeting Wim Hof. This is where I'm meeting, you know, the monk, Geelong Thubten, who, are you familiar with the movie Dr. No, Dr. Strange?
Yes. Yeah, the most recent one. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty recent. A few years ago, it was, I think, a Marvel. I didn't even see the movie, but I remember the promos. It was a very popular movie. The actor's a British guy.
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah. So anyway, they brought in this Geelong Thubten, this Tibetan Buddhist monk, to train Benedict as well as the cast in mindfulness, because apparently in the movie they were using powers of the mind, you know. So interesting people that, you know, that this Mindvalley curates. And these are some of the people. So I met Wim Hof, and I, you know, after meeting him, I had heard about him a few years before, and, you know, someone I respect mentioned him way before anybody even knew who he was. But I never really went deep. And then meeting him in person, it inspired me. Okay, now I'm practicing the Wim Hof method. Now I have my intro from Wim Hof, and he's an amazing individual. So I went through his whole, you know, 10-week. I did the ice. I was doing 30 minutes in the ice bath because I didn't know that you're only supposed to do like 2-3 minutes. And, you know, I'm a good student. So it's like the tech, like he talks about, anyone can do it. So it's just doing it again. If I was recommending it, I would probably tell most people not to start with 30 minutes because it's, you know, it could be too much too soon. I didn't injure myself, but, you know, I don't have a lifestyle. I don't have like a tub of ice tub in my, where I live, where I can just daily jump into it. So I use it now more. You know, I started jiu-jitsu 2 years ago. So if I'm about to go, you know, a couple of days before jiu-jitsu tournament, I'll start taking ice baths for like, you know, those 3 or 4 days or a week before, and just, you know, because if I feel like I need to make myself uncomfortable for some reason to prepare myself, I'll do it. But it's not day to day. A cold shower does the trick. You know, in the training, you maybe go up to 5 minutes. You know, 5 minutes or beyond. But honestly, in San Diego, the water doesn't get that cold. So it's only in the winter time, where like ambient temperature, where it's like, okay, now I feel cold. But on my travel, like, you know, you never know. Like I went to Norway in the springtime, and that was the coldest shower I ever had at the hotel I was staying. And that cold shower was, it felt colder than the ice baths, you know? So it really depends. But in terms of like Wim Hof, where he lives in Amsterdam and where he grew up as a kid, there's cold lakes. So he developed a culture where he literally is every day jumping into the cold lake. And he built his lifestyle around that. But as for me, that's not where I'm at, where I'm doing the full. But what I've learned from him is it's in the mind and the breathing. You know, the mind is the commander. And I've known that forever, but he's helped me, you know, because the martial arts and even triathlon training, everything is, it's the mind and what you want to do with it. So what he figured out is, okay, the breathing, which is as old as life itself, the mind goes into the cell, and then from there you can direct it. And once you learn to override, you know, the adrenaline response and the nervous system, now you can stay relaxed, and you learn how to store the oxygen into the cells. So now you don't even need to breathe, right? So now you can survive. And he figured that out. You can apply that to, you know, and for me, everything is beliefs. So okay, you grew up, you've grown up, and now you're an adult, and your whole life you believe certain things, right? You believe you're going to get old. You believe you're going to get sick. You believe you're going to die, you know, and the world all around you believes it. And that's, so it becomes, you start using your mind in a different way. Now you're healing your body. Okay, now you're no longer a slave to the pharmaceuticals, you know, to a lot of things. And that's really what he's teaching. When I look inside his message, where I learn about the man, and you know, it's about love at the, you know, if you distill it down, it's about the love, and that's the work. We're all doing the same work. Just we come in at a different, you know, so you do the training, but once you do the training, you master it, you become the master of the training. And that's, I'm not saying I'm the master. Wim Hof is the grandmaster, you know. So I defer to him in that system because that's his system, you know. But I'm a proponent and I'm a practitioner. And I believe you take the technique, you make it your own. You can always use, you know. But yeah, the cold makes you go into it. So the cold, if you don't want to go into it, you don't know how to go into it, go into the cold. And the cold makes you go into it because you either go into it or you die. So, but.
Well, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was reading some Wim Hof stuff and I thought, right, I'm going to do the cold showers. I'm just going to start today. And I remember him talking about the breathing. You just mentioned that there. And so, you know, I just thought, right, let's go in, turn the shower on cold, leave it on cold. And instead of letting out a squeal, I just take a big breath in. And then as I get out, just let it all out. And then, you know, the first 8 or 10 breaths, probably, it's feeling cold. And then, you know what, as you focus on the breathing, you don't seem to notice the cold as much. I keep moving around, so it's, targeting different parts of my body. I actually measured the temperature of the water the other day. It was, I think it was 42 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 7 degrees centigrade. It has got a bit colder here in the UK in the last few weeks. So, and I'm sure it will get colder than that, but that seems pretty cold. I could do 2 minutes quite comfortably now. And by that point, my head's hurting a little bit. My feet are getting cold. I can feel my hands getting cold, but and somebody asked me, well, why are you doing this? And I had to think for a little bit, you know, there's supposed to be some immune system benefits, but really it was that thing you just mentioned. It's controlling the mind. You know, what's the worst that's going to happen is I can turn the water on warm or I can step out. But we don't do very much in our days these days to get uncomfortable. And for 2 minutes, the thought of making myself uncomfortable before it and then making myself uncomfortable is a little bit unpleasant. The after effects, when you get the warm shower, you feel fantastic. And so, you know, I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's, you know, and the thing with that is what makes Wim Hof unique and different than the teachers before him, because all it is a lineage. It's information. Nobody invented it, right? Mm-hmm. Is he's got the science. The scientists looked at him and did the study and then did the double blind, and they had to change the books, and they're changing the books because they didn't know. And it's like this, it's life. You have the acid, you have the alkaline, it's the pH, you know, the biology, the biological, you know, biosphere that we exist within, you know, that 0.7, that's where we want to be dialed into that. We start getting acidic, and most of the things are making us acidic. So it's through the, and that's kind of what it does biologically. And, you know, Wim Hof was doing it his whole life, and he was the weirdo, the freak guy that, you know, oh yeah, he does it. And he was on local TV, and people in that area of Holland, they knew about him and heard about him, but that was it. Then he became an international phenomenon where he can have audience with anyone that he wants to in the world now. You know, Oprah seeks him out, you know what I'm saying, or whatever. So why is that? You know, why is that? Because he's a yogi. It's breathing. Yogis have been teaching breathing since, you know, the first Sanskrit yogic texts where God revealed and left these teachings with us. So modern humanity is in a crisis, and we are here to help them. We are here to, you know, help save ourselves and save humanity. You know, our ancestors were no different. The early hominids, you know, maybe not the early hominids, were a little different, but we were hanging in trees You know, we were carrying sticks. It was fire. You know, rope, sticks, stones, and the early technologies. And so we've moved very far from that. And, you know, I roll with the, you know, Wim Hof is teaching people how to breathe again. And my friend David Weck is teaching people how to locomote, you know, because we've forgotten these things. And it's early man was doing it. Early man was the animal, the natural athlete. We were not existing on two-dimensional, you know, we're three-dimensional. We're not existing on two-dimensional, paved, perfectly pristine, you know, messing up our feet, wearing cushiony high heel, you know.
We're
And so Wim Hof, you know, with the breathing, with the Wim Hof, it's like back in the day, you're running, you're jumping, you're hunting, you're surviving. You know, the adrenaline's coursing and the disease gets burned out. There's no disease existing because we're alkaline. And then now we're like sitting in our laptops and, you know, driving around and boom, we're, you know, we're not moving. We're not. So that's why we have all these, you know, so the Wim Hof, they did the study at Harvard. They injected the groups, all of them, with this Ebola virus, low dosages. You know, it's not going to kill you, but it makes you sick, gives you runny nose and all that stuff. So injected in all the ones that were not doing Wim Hof, 8 week or whatever it was, 10 week protocol. They all got sick. They all got runny nose and congestion and fever and, you know, all upset stomach, all that. And the ones that were trained in Wim Hof, they all didn't get sick. And then they figured out, you know, so there is science that validates it. It burns it out, the technique. It burns out the virus. It creates an alkaline state, and disease cannot exist in alkaline. Disease flourishes in the acidic environment. And well, there's nothing more than breathing that can bring us to alkaline faster. I think the second thing is going to be our nutrition. And then, of course, the environment itself, because if they're pumping, you know, fluoride and stuff into the air and water, you know, it makes it more difficult for us to alkalinize. But we can still do it through the mind.
Well, I'll put a link to some of the Wim Hof books and some of the work that he does, Steve. That's, there you go. There's one of the rabbit holes I said would disappear down. But that's really interesting. You know, there's a book by...
Look at his website. Wim Hof Method, I think, is even better than the books, because you can see the videos and...
Mm. Cool. Okay, well, look, it sounds like you are you find that Wim Hof a pretty inspirational character. Who else inspires you in your life, Steve?
Well, you know, I would say, yes, Wim Hof, definitely. I would say that every mother in the world since the beginning of time, because we have to respect the mother, we have to respect the Mother Earth and the woman, because if it were not for the woman, you know, we would not be able to exist, you know. And I think that there's historical characters, you know, but it's like, if I don't know the person, there's some great stories out there. And then we look deep into the stories and we found these great people did some horrible things, you know. If we filter it through the lens of today and look back and what was acceptable in certain times or not acceptable anymore, you know, so I'm pretty cautious to, you know, I'd like, you know, a guy, certainly someone, Jesus Christ is someone I admire. And, you know, and there's others that have done great things, but I don't know of anyone that has done great things that I necessarily want to emulate, because everyone's got to kind of find their own way, be themselves, you know? So the list is probably long if I were to name any one person, but I would say the mother is probably the more important role model, or someone that I appreciate and admire. And that's all mothers, you know, my mother, all mothers, because, you know, they're very precious.
That's a great choice, Stephen, and some great comments there that I'm sure that you'll gain a lot of respect for from a lot of mothers who feel that they're overlooked perhaps in the work they do.
It's sincere. I'll say it. Yeah. You know, it's true. actually. Yeah. And, you know, I want people to start remembering that. Because if we want to create a better world, we have to take care of, you know, our families first and foremost. That means our mothers, our daughters, our wives, our children, you know, each other. So, if there's a foundation or sort of a societal standard that wants to subjugate that, you can't polish a turd. You know what I'm saying? You need to change the narrative. That's how I see it.
That's good for me, Steve. So listen, you're an interesting character. Right, let's say that Hollywood came down and said they wanted to make a film of your life. Who would you choose to play you?
I would definitely have to play myself. Yeah. Oh. It would have to star in my own movie because I don't think that anyone is well versed enough. There's not an actor that is going to be able to pull it off right now that I'm aware of. And if there is, I would definitely like to meet that person. I would do a casting call and see if, you know, but there's no names that I have right now.
Okay. Cool. That's an interesting answer too. You're definitely coming up with some good ones today, Steve.
Thank you.
How about superpowers then? If you were going to be bestowed with one superpower, what would it be?
The power to remember.
The power to remember.
Yes.
Do you have a good memory or do you tend to forget things?
No, I have a good memory. I have a good memory, but I don't remember all things of all times. Mm. And I would like to be able to remember all things from all times.
Wow.
Yeah. I want to remember this.
Yeah, this moment.
Exactly.
Every moment. I mean, I think if you do your meditation and probably every single day that we have is packed full of memorable moments that most of them get consigned to the trash bin because we just don't have enough capacity to remember everything. So there's just significant things, but it might be the moment that somebody opened the door for you in a shop or stopped to let you cross the road that's as memorable as, you know, winning the lottery.
Time can pass us by, as the saying goes. And yeah, I think it's a superpower, definitely.
Well, you know, we just talked about it. It's 8 years since we first met, and last met as well. And I was chatting with some friends today. We were saying that as we come up to the end of the year, it's the end of a decade as well. But then somebody said, yeah, but do you remember the millennium 20 years ago now? It doesn't seem like 20 years since we were celebrating the year 2000, but it is.
True. It was, I was stocking up on water and canned goods for the Y2K.
yeah, like most people. Yeah. I know you said you like to read, you like to write, Steve. Do you read much as well? Do you read books?
Yeah, I'm voracious. Well, audio. I discovered the power of the audio book. And, you know, I'm just shy of 300. I found it in June. So I'm, at any given moment, I'm running 5 books all the time, like, because I travel a lot, that's with me. Yeah, so books all the time, almost all my waking hours. If I'm not on the podcast with you or something, I'm gonna be listening to books.
What was, if you've got 5 on the go, what was the last book that you finished, and what was the best book that you've read in recent months, do you think?
Well, one of them, you know, the book I'm reading is the amazing book. The 1421 is the year the Chinese discovered America. So it's talking about, you know, in the last 30 years, especially with the carbon dating, we've been able to verify so many records of history and things that we didn't know. But, you know, the Europeans didn't come out till like the late 1500, and the Chinese were all around for, you know, 7 years before that. So that's pretty interesting. So many, but I'm loving history, the joy of history, ancient civilizations, a day in the life of, you know, say a Sumerian or Babylonian, or, you know, religious texts. Just all information. And when you read a lot, you sort of don't remember any single one unless it was super impactful. So I listen a lot to The Great Courses. Are you familiar with that series?
I'm not.
The Great Courses is lectures. They get university lecturers, professors. And they're generally excellent. You know, there's not too many. Actually, they're all excellent. Some of them are more boring, but I'm not looking to be entertained. You know, so it's, you know, but in particular, I'm always gravitating towards the history, towards the philosophy. I like to circle back, you know, through the economics. I'll look at some finance stuff and, you know, or if there's interesting characters in terms of biography, but, you know, so really a lot of books. And I don't think there's such a thing as a bad book. It's very, very unusual that I won't finish something. Unless it's like a parody, like a comedian that's just telling jokes, and then be like, okay, this is not what I thought it was. And, you know, but information-wise, that's what I'm interested in. So in that regard, even if it's not something I'm interested in, even if it's not a topic that is, you know, once I start it, I'm going to finish it.
You travel a lot, Steve. Do you have many holidays, or are you mostly working?
Got one coming up, actually tomorrow. Going to Italy tomorrow.
You mentioned that, yeah. So if you
a full on holiday.
If you could only go to one holiday spot for the rest of your life, where would that be?
I'm thinking probably need a private island, and it's going to be in the Caribbean, or you know maybe if I can find a nice private island in the South Pacific. As well, I'm going to change that answer. It's going to be the South Pacific, maybe Hawaii, maybe some of the Hawaiian islands or thereabouts. I haven't checked out Fiji, you know, kind of the French Polynesia. I'd like to look around there, but that's what strikes me right now.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Hawaii myself. The Big Island. I go there every year for the Ironman.
Is that right? Yeah.
I need to branch out and explore some of those smaller islands, but they're quite difficult to get to, and they're pricey as well, aren't they?
Yes. You got to go to maybe Australia, and then once a week there's one flight that goes, and then you're not going to be getting back anytime soon. So yeah. You got to sort of be ready to put everything else aside if you're going to go out to that part of the world.
You have. Again, you mentioned Wim Hof there, but if you could choose anybody, either maybe you've come across some already, or maybe you'd like to come across them, but you could choose anyone to mentor you for 1 month, who would it be? You have to choose one, Steve, because I know there's probably quite a long list.
Actually, I'd like to do that with Jack Ma.
Okay, I'm not familiar with him.
I saw him speak recently. He's the founder of Alibaba. He's okay. a pretty well-known Chinese multi-billionaire. But I saw him recently, briefly, speak at a... It was just a conversation with Elon Musk and him. So he's sort of... like opposite of Elon Musk in a lot of ways in his thoughts. Elon Musk all about AI and going out there, and Jack Ma was all about like, let's stay here and let's focus on the human. And that struck me. So if I'm going to just be mentored by a billionaire, because now I'm into the phase of life where, okay, now I'm becoming a businessman and paying attention and making deals and looking at what, you know, the work there, of how I'm going to impact the world. So when you start thinking in that terms, you need to be educated in the way of business. Mm-hmm. So I figure I need a good business mentor. And if I'm going to pick any billionaire, I want to pick someone that seems to make sense versus somebody that just has a lot of money but doesn't offer any sort of mental and emotional stimulation. Mm-hmm. You know, so Jack Ma definitely is the guy that seems like he's got a lot to offer, and that's going to be my choice. Yeah.
Oh, I like that. You've come up with some different answers there, Steve. So nice. Thank you. Thank you for that. So that's the warm up over. We can get into the main conversation now, although we've done pretty well so far.
Okay.
Let me. When we first met, Steve, you came to Harrogate in Yorkshire to run a 2-day kettlebell workshop. Now, I'd dabbled with kettlebells. I'd lifted weights most of my life, free weights. You know, I'd become an Olympic lifting coach, so I could transfer that skill onto the athletes. I didn't know what was going to happen with kettlebells, and I decided I was going to cycle over to Harrogate from my house, and then at the last minute we decided not to, and I'm glad I didn't, because I don't think I could walk for a couple of days after we'd finished. But I learned a totally new way of working out, and I'm still using kettlebells now. In fact, right here in my kitchen, I've got one 16K bell that I use most days. How did you get involved with kettlebells, Steve? And what? Because I know you. I remember you telling me you had some sort of gymnastic background, and you wowed us with these single leg squats onto and off a table.
Well, it actually wasn't gymnastics in the way that, you know, we would normally. I mean, gymnastics is a sport, and my background in movement and acrobatics was through Chinese martial arts. So I've never had any formal gymnastics training. As a boy, I was involved in Chinese martial arts starting at 12 years old, and that became my, you know, my first profession and my first expertise. I taught for many, many years, and that was before I got involved with kettlebell. So based on that, you know, with regards to the kettlebell, I'm really one of the early adopters for kettlebell. And I'm really, truth be told, I'm the OG of kettlebell in the sense that I'm still active. Whoever might have been before me, and there was just a few, they're not really involved in kettlebells, where I'm still very involved in kettlebells. So I've sort of taken the mantle as the early adapter that's still heavily involved, because we're going back to 2002. And, you know, when the story's told, you have the kettlebell, the history, which goes back. And again, we're talking about the Russian kettlebell, because there's other tools in other cultures that have similar properties, but we got to specify what we're talking about. So when people say kettlebell, they're really referring to Russian kettlebell. And that's a specific use, a specific shape, and a specific application. So the Russian kettlebell, there's sort of the history going back to the 1700s when it was first recorded. And then there's the modern history, which starts in 2001. And that's with the publication of the Russian kettlebell challenge, Pavel Satsalin. So I was one of the very early adopters when Pavel Satsalin created his kettlebell program, which is, you know, that was 2002, which was the RKC, right? So the first sort of educational course that was a certification course for kettlebell. So I got involved with that very quickly, adapted it very quickly, got involved in sort of the inner circle senior hierarchy of teaching, you know, with Pavel, and then grew from there. And that's, you know, so that's going back 2002. And, you know, so what year are we now? We're about to turn 2020. So 18 years. And the reason is because I saw the promotions in, it was in a martial art catalog, actually, called Vitalix. Because as I just mentioned, I was very involved in the Chinese martial arts. I received this Vitalix catalog from Dragon Door Publications.
And Dragon Door, yeah, I was going to mention them. Yeah.
Well, Dragon Door is still around. They're still publishing, and, you know, still offering information on fitness and related topics, you know. But at that time, they were almost exclusively martial arts and Chinese martial arts, and more towards the Qigong, the Tai Chi, the Qigong. Pavel had, you know, some products. First, it was a stretching. There was a Beyond Crunches, which was an abdominal training. There was the stretching, Beyond Stretching, flexibility. And I never purchased the products, but it was like a quarterly at that time, or maybe a monthly. I think it was still a quarterly, you know, so quarterly would receive this Dragon Door publication. I was a young guy. I was early 30s. You know, but even since my late 20s, I was receiving this, never really bought much, because I was a guy that, you know, didn't have much money. So I bought maybe a couple Tai Chi videos. And I saw this Pavel, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. This is interesting. Then I saw the kettlebell, probably starting 2001. So I kind of thought about it for almost a year. figuring out, oh, this kettlebell looks interesting, but I didn't bite the bullet. And then finally, I was still teaching martial arts, you know, going to school full time at that point. And then I was teaching martial arts on the weekend at a park down the road here in San Diego. And so I showed this catalog to some of my students, and 2 weeks later, he shows up. He's got a couple kettlebells. So I pick it up for the first time, and then I'm like, oh, I got to get my own, right? So I ordered my own, got the video, trained myself in my living room, and then, you know, went from there. Said, oh, I'm going to go meet this Pavel guy, go to his course, went to his course. Pavel's like, oh, wow, you know how to do this stuff. You know, I was a martial artist, so I picked it up quickly. And I say that, but honestly, you know, time and place, we didn't know then what we know now. So I picked it up quickly for what was kettlebell at that time, which was a very basic stripped down version of the entirety, you know, the Iron Curtain had not fallen yet at that point in time. And we didn't have access to all the body of work, you know, which didn't open up for another decade after that. So, yeah, so that's the beginning, and I stayed with it, and I saw the opportunity in 2007 to start bringing it all around the world. And 2006, I got my first taste of international, and then 2007 started doing seminars all around the world. And, 2008, I started a kettlebell certification, IKFF. Since then, I've brought kettlebells to more than 60 countries. And, you know, so it's pretty ubiquitous now. Most people, especially if they're involved in fitness in any capacity, at least have heard of kettlebell, have seen kettlebell, and a good chance they've picked up a kettlebell at least once or twice in their life. So it's certainly here to stay. But I don't know if we can say it's, I guess that there's a degree of mainstream, but I don't think there's mainstream understanding of kettlebell. I know for sure there's not mainstream understanding of it.
I've read a bit about, I've seen some of Pavel's books, and I know he has this Russian kettlebell challenge, which you mentioned there, which seems to be, as you say, a series of challenges requiring you to do X number of this in a certain time and set number of that. But my sense from meeting you in Harrogate is your certification is more about you learning to use the kettlebells and then being able to pass that on to other people, whereas the RKC is more about just a badge of honor for being able to do a certain number of reps or something. Is that the right interpretation, or am I completely off track?
Well, I won't say you're wrong. I don't speak for RKC. What I will say is that I believe in empowering the individual. I've never been interested in developing a groupthink mentality in terms of it's not contingent upon you being a part of my group for you to gain benefit and for you to use it. So my responsibility is to educate, and then you take that education and you use it in your life in a way that is ultimately useful for you. And if I had my druthers, I would love that you did it and you taught a lot of people and helped a lot of people. And then, you know, within that, there's some business models that we can look at as well. However, for me, it's about the education. It's not about the system itself, because I believe that the student at some point in the journey becomes the master. And, you know, so that's not for everyone, but that's how I've always seen it. And that's my exposure through the martial arts and through my principles is if you, you know, it's always points of entry, and anyone within reason, as long as there's no physical contraindications that would indicate that they should not, you know, but most people considering health can gain benefit from kettlebell. I don't say all people, because there are movement restrictions, and there's very few things that are for all people. I think the only thing that is for all people is breathing, you know, and drinking water and having food and, you know, then some movement. That's sort of the universal things that everybody, you know, eating. And then there's, of course, elimination. You got to be able to eliminate, you know, but there's just a few things that everybody has to do. And then in terms of exercise, there's no one thing that everybody has to do, right? Because if you're a triathlete, you have to do those certain things, but that's not everybody. And I can say late lifting weights, but that's not everybody. Or running, well, that's not everybody. Not everybody even walks. Some people don't have arms. Some people don't have legs. Some people are quadriplegics, paraplegics, right? So there's no exercise that everybody needs to do. So when we look at kettlebell, it offers great benefit, and I would say most people, you know. So if you fall under that category, now from there, how far do you want to take it? You want to burn a couple calories, or do you want to be the best that's ever lived? Or is it somewhere in between, right? Or are you going to play a sport and you want it to help you so you can play the sport at a higher level and be more sustainable and injury-free? You know, so that's really the kind of the big picture. And not everybody needs to be great, but what everybody does need is safe and effective technique so that they can, first of all, not injure themselves. And my main audience has always been fitness professionals. So if you're a fitness professional, the ethic is not to injure those that you're serving, mm-hmm. your clients, if you will, or your students. So, you know, that's where I come in, and I'm providing the information that you can take that, you can do it safely and effectively, and you're going to be able to do that the rest of your life. Whether you teach others or not is a different. If you're teaching others, that's a higher degree of qualification, you know, where you're going to have to be vetted and you have to test out to make sure that your fundamentals are good enough that I can put my confidence and my name behind you saying, you know, you are qualified to teach this information to others, you know. So that's what I've done. And, you know, but I don't make a comparison to RKC or anyone else, because there's different ways of doing it. And I think there's good in all, but I'm not emulating how others are doing it either, or even comparing. But I do believe in the power of the individual. I want you to be great. I don't want you to have to be dependent upon me for the rest of your kettlebell existence.
You mentioned there a few things once you got talking about, you got onto the bit about specifics of using kettlebells to get better at what you do, to be injury-free, to have more strength and mobility. Particularly as a coach in triathlon, I want my triathletes to be robust. I want them to be, have bodies that are resilient and able to absorb all of the swim, bike and run that they do. And one other thing about triathlon is it's the movements are cyclical. So we repeat the same movements over and over again in the same patterns. And, you know, I think we worked out that you do several hundred thousand of those patterns of each movement over a period of, you know, 12 months. So if the technique isn't pretty good, it's easy to get injured or create chronic problems. But equally, a lot of those other muscles that you're not using extensively get underutilized. But I just wanted to know whether you thought that kettlebells are a better choice for most people than going to the gym and using machines or free weights or body weight, you know, or would you have a mix of those within a workout? Could you do something, a workout that's exclusively kettlebells and get some really good strength development that prepares you for the sport you choose to do?
It is absolutely better than going to the gym in the large majority of cases. In fact, it's not necessary to go to a gym. So we can't separate the kettlebell from the body. So body weight has to be a component of any other training system, regardless of where it's being paired with, quite because the body is the mechanism and then every secondary is the tool. So kettlebell is a tool, which is an extension of the body. extension of the hand, if you will, since it's a handheld tool. And in that sense, it's like a weapon. It's a tool that has an application. And so the body is the mechanism that is driving the use of the tool. And whatever movement we want to look at or whatever tool you choose, it could be a barbell, it could be a dumbbell, it could be a some other apparatus or some other loaded implement. However, the technique of how you use it is based on how you're using your body. So that's fundamental. If we're talking about triathlon, which we are, you're using your body, whether it's in the swim, the run, the bike, you're using your body. So we have to look at posture. We have to look at the breathing and how we're coordinated the breathing with the specific movement. We have to look at the posture. And again, your endurance, kettlebell as a sport is also cyclical, like triathlon. You know, you're doing repetitive movement, can be hundreds, and in a kettlebell marathon, it can be thousands, where you're lifting for 30 minutes without stopping, 1 hour without stopping. Some cases, even in a world record level, up to 12 hours without stopping. So depending on the degree, but it has the component of the aerobic, cyclical, repetitive. However, for almost, you know, aside from a small percentage of kettlebell users in the kettlebell sport, everyone else is using kettlebell for general fitness, in which case you're doing many different movements, not to the same degree of repetition, and you're introducing many different planes of motion. So it's far superior to the conventional models. First and foremost, you're on your feet. You have to look at your posture. So, you know, the common vernacular is core strength, core stability. That's what people hear about. You can use that if it helps you to understand that. I don't use that terminology. I say midline, you know, midline strength, midline control. You can call it your core, but it's that central axis, you know, so your referential to the vertical, which is the gravity, you know, that's your posture. There's a lot of difficulties with that in a seasoned triathlete, unless they're really meticulous about their overall cross training, which I think for the large percentage probably are not, you know, so you're going to be having back discomfort. You're going to be having, you know, joint discomforts, you know, ankle, knee, hip, just from the repetition and the amount of time that's put in. So you're putting in hours every week of, you know, running, cycling, swimming. Are you also putting in hours of, you know, elongating the tissues and looking at your posture and how's your breathing? So probably not, because you have a family, you have to work, right? You cannot train 10 hours a day. If you're a professional and that's all you do, then yes, you do have to train 10 hours a day. But that's not what keeps triathlon in business, right? It's the recreational. Even those that are serious, it's still recreational. So, you know, kettlebells is probably going to be your best cross training, you know, quite because you can't do everything. So you can only do something. So what are we going to do? Let's get our return on investment. You know, the kettlebell, you got your posture, you got your breathing, now you got your endurance, and you have the stamina. But it's not just cardio, which your triathlon is already training, you know, VO2 max cardiovascular to a very high degree. So, you know, a logical question is, do I need to do more in my cross training, or maybe I need to do strength training? Well, the thing about kettlebell is they're combining those things. You're getting the resistance, but you're able to get the resistance in a way that's complementing the aerobic. So you're getting anaerobic and aerobic, you know, and you can manipulate that with the kettlebell depending, you know. So if you're doing a finish in, say, a marathon, and you're that last portion, if you're really competitive, that last portion is your kick. That's your anaerobic component of the, you know, but the rest of it is aerobic to get you that, right? So in kettlebell, you can train that and really dial that in, and you can get the anaerobic way, way higher. We're talking, you know, 200 beats per minute, more, you know, you can get more, but very easily into the 180s and above, you know, so how else are you going to do that? Like sprints? Probably not, because sprints is way, unless you're a sprinter, or, you know, sprints is very aggressive on the tissues and, you know, good luck not pulling something, but you can definitely mimic that energy cycle doing, you know, double kettlebell jerks, you know, heavy kettlebell swings, you know, some jump squats. There's ways that you can get up, hike your maximal heart rate very, very high. So there's a lot of benefits with it. There's also the grip. We're looking at the trunk extensors, which is huge for triathlon. You're spending so many hours hunched over on a bicycle, you know, so working against the gravity, getting that extension, you're getting, you know, snatch where you're way, you know, overhead and extension. The bar is not a great tool for most people, because yes, you do Olympic lifting, you do the, and I'm not saying I'm against it. It's good if you know what you're doing, but there is a degree of technical, and unless you have superb flexibility and specialized flexibility, most people are compensating to get into the position for the overhead squat and for the snatch with the Olympic bar. And it takes years and years and years for an Olympic lifter to develop that specialized flexibility where they can rest and be comfortable. That's not most people. And what age were you when you started? Were you already in your 30s? Were you in your 40s? So your body's already formed. You see, so there's a lot wrong with that approach, and it's popularized by CrossFit. I'm not saying CrossFit's bad. You know, it's great at what it is, obviously. Who am I? You know, the consumer loves it. So, you know, will it still be around in 30 years? We'll see, you know, or maybe it'll be very different. Probably it will be very different, but that's its strength, its ability to adapt, right? But in terms of, hey, everybody should be Olympic lifting, no, no way. And kettlebells is much easier entry point for that overhead, because now you can unilateral it. It's designed for that. And you don't have to be pinned on a frontal plane. And, you know, you have some degrees of freedom to where if your body isn't as flexible, you can find the position and develop the position in over time in a way that's safe and doesn't. So for most people, the kettlebell is a better choice for what we're talking about here. Get off the bike and now you're standing, you know, put it in your trunk or strap it in your back seat, you know, put it in a box. Drive out to where you're going to go on your ride. And then, you know, when you're done with your ride, do some swings, do some presses, do some goblet squats. You're good to go and you feel great. And you're stronger than, you know, it's strength training. And I think triathletes probably need more strength training. They need strength training in a way that is fits. They can do it in a little bit of time.
You hit on a couple of good points there, Steve. You mentioned quite perceptively that most triathletes don't do the strength training. Most of the time, that excuse is because they think they need to do more swim, bike, and run. Particularly in longer distances, my observations are that most people are slowing down towards the end of the run. It happens in the second half of the run. The hips and the back tighten up, their stride length goes, their calf muscles stop working effectively in that spring that they get from the Achilles tendon. So they're basically shuffling. You can see them folding over at the shoulders so that they're almost sort of shuffling forward in a stooped position. And they're not slowing down because they're out of breath. They're slowing down because their body is stopping working. So each step takes more energy, and as it takes more energy, they get more tired, and so they're slowing down. They do a lot of repetition, as you mentioned. They have a lack of time because they're trying to fit all this training in around work. So they're typically getting up early, they go into the pool, they go straight off to work, they go to the gym at lunchtime, or they go out for a run, then they go home. They've got families. There just isn't the time in the day. And the things that I like that I've started to appreciate more over the years is you can do a small amount of stuff every day. You know, one thing we've got to do is get away from the old bodybuilding methods that you've got to train different body parts on different days. You know, the body doesn't work in individuals. It works as a whole. When you're swimming, biking, and running, when you're moving, the whole body's involved. So if we find a way of lifting that involves the whole body, that works that, that challenges balance as well and challenges things unilaterally. I think we need to do that. And we need to find ways of getting this stuff done where it fits into our day. And so if it means not going to the gym, then that's going to save a lot of people an awful lot of travel time when they're actually just sitting in traffic doing nothing, you know. So if you have to travel 30 minutes to get to the gym for a 30-minute workout and then 30 minutes back, it's a no-brainer. Who wants to waste time like that? If you can just go outside in the yard and do a 15-minute kettlebell workout, it's way more productive.
It's perfect. You hit on three key points. It's time, so it's bang for buck, and it's accessibility, which also deals with time, and resiliency. The resiliency, you know, that's the breakdown you're talking about at the, you know, the long distances. Regardless, the obviously swimming, no, you're buoyant, but the breakdown in the running, the breakdown in the cycling, it's the fatigue of the tissue, and that's what kettlebells is famous for. It's the resilience. It's you're strong when everyone else is tired. You know, everyone's tired. It's the end, and you're able to still keep going. That's what kettlebells is, because it's the repetition, but now it's with the weight. And so now I have the endurance, but I have endurance with strength at the end. And, you know, it's putting that turbocharge on top of the endurance athlete, because a kettlebell lifter is an endurance athlete, but they're the endurance athlete that has strength. And, you know, so for me, it goes together like, I would say, jam and croissants, you know, it's just, or tea and biscuits. It just that's really the cross training that triathletes need to be doing. It's going to tick all the boxes, because you don't need to go to the gym. So, because the thing about what I believe also about triathletes, not knowing, you know, not being one myself, they're go-getters. They get things done, because that's not something you can do without being committed. You know, if you're non-committal, like, you're missing days, you're missing miles, and now you cannot compete. So that's just a driven personality that's out. And so on top of that, now you want to really raise your performance, and you know that you have to do cross training, but you're not educated in it. You're not sure where to go. And so you're looking around, listening to other people. Oh, this guy does this. You know, where's your life go? So now you just need 15 minutes. You do it 3 days a week. That's all you need to do. And you're working three-dimensional. So you're not doing body parts. You're not going to the gym and back and, you know, doing selectorized movements, which have no mind-muscle connection. Now you're strengthening those muscles to where you have the endurance in your back. You're not folding over. And, you know, you have that spring because it's strength training. You need strength training, but you don't need to do so much that it's cutting into your endurance training. And that's why kettlebells is the perfect tool.
Yeah, so we really need to find a way of complementing everything, don't we? So that the kettlebells complement the swim, bike, and run. So let's assume that somebody's been listening to our conversation for an hour, Steve. Let's hope they are anyway. And they are now convinced that they need to take a look at kettlebells. How would somebody go about getting started? Is it as simple as ordering a kettlebell, or should they go and get some instruction from a qualified coach to learn the basic movements?
They definitely need coaching. And so all I can say with 100% confidence is myself as a reference for YouTube, because it's not costing anybody anything. And if they're watching this, they have access to the internet. So, and I know that my instruction is technically correct. I know that if you follow anything I say about kettlebell, you're not going to learn incorrect information. You're not going to learn dangerous. So that's the only thing I can 100% recommend, and make it as easy as possible. If you're in UK, you can order from Wolverson's. If you're in United States, you can offer from kettlebell kings, or sorry, order. You know, you can order a kettlebell from Wolverson's in the UK. You can order a kettlebell from Kettlebell Kings in the US. If you're in Asia, order from Ziva and get the Steve Cotter signature line, because that's the best kettlebell. And it's my kettlebell. You know, but get your kettlebell. Don't get it at Target. Don't get it at the sporting goods store, because more often than not, you're not going to get the good kettlebell. You know, it's not the right dimension. And then if you don't want to invest in a local trainer, if you have a trainer, get a trainer, but that's not, everybody doesn't have access, you know, so go online, go to YouTube, look at my videos. There's other good people as well, you know, but there's a lot of information on the internet, and not all information is good information. So I don't think just putting kettlebell in a search engine and seeing what pops up is a good suggestion for anybody.
Well, you know what we'll do, Steve, is when we finish the show, I will get some links from you to your channel. I'm going to show you. I've just picked up my kettlebell here, actually. So this is a Wolverson one, and I think this is what you're talking about, isn't it? This is a 16K. So it's got some of the things about that. They've all come the same, pretty much the same size, don't they? They've got a big stable flat bottom. They've got this more of a square handle rather than the rounded one, which gives you stability when you're doing some of the other exercises. What are the other benefits of buying those particular models that you talk about there?
The only reason I recommend them is just because it's a brand I know. You know, I started teaching today as far as seminars, first time ever, 2007, and you know, so Wolverson has been around, you know, for a long time. They've been in business, been providing. So I happen to know that company, and I know you're in UK. Mm. That's why I met, you know, there's other companies I know that sell kettlebells. So it's not about me playing favorites. It's about me knowing a company that has stood the test of time.
But I'm thinking more about the particular shape. I know that there was some stuff that you mentioned when we were training about having a stable bottom and the type of the handle that they have.
So there's a basic, you know, basically there's two broad, there's what are called the competition or the sport, which is what you just showed. And then there's what's normally called the cast iron. And the cast iron, it's different sizes as the weights progress, you know. So they're using a different mold, and it's a mold that the kettlebell gets bigger as it gets heavier. The competition, it's a hollow mold, and then it's filled as it gets heavier. So the dimensions stay the same. I much prefer the competition because there's a consistency. You learn the technique, and then the position doesn't change as you progress up or down in the load. And so there's just a consistency of technique and positioning that you can develop. Having said that, if it's a good quality cast iron, some people do prefer to train with cast iron. More usually it's because that's what they're familiar with and that's what they learned on. But in some cases, for example, if it's a child, if it's a small person, either a small woman or even a very small man, the competition kettlebell might be too big, the spacing for their hand. You know, so in that sense, a smaller dimension may fit better. But as a general recommendation, if you're average size, I definitely recommend the competition kettlebell.
And they go up in 4 kilo increments, don't they? Is that right?
You know, they actually will go in 2 kilo. Commonly 4 kilo. But yeah, I'm sure Wolverson probably has 2 kilo increments. The companies that are really, you know, specializing kettlebells in the last several years, they've begun, you know, just because there's a greater demand among the hardcore kettlebellistas, you know, the people that are into kettlebell sport, they want the 2 kilo, because if you're in kettlebell sport, you're not doing sets of 5 and 10, you're doing sets of 50, 100 or more. And so 4 kilos is a big jump when you're doing sets of 100.
Okay.
You know, so 2 kilos is more manageable in terms of the progressive overload. But for general fitness, 4 kilo is sufficient.
Going back to our avatar person then who's decided they want to get started, they've gone to YouTube, they've looked at some of your, or they're going to look at some of your videos on there, Steve, your instructional kettlebell videos. What movements would you suggest that they start with? But I guess the things like the kettlebell swing and learning to swing with two hands and then one hand and then being able to alternate and catch is probably a good base movement because there's a lot of other stuff that develops from there. But
you're exactly right. So the split is the foundation. Body set in motion stays in motion. It's Newton's, you know, law of motion, the law of inertia. That's the fundamental biomechanical principle of kettlebell. You get it moving, you keep it moving, and that creates the cyclical effect. That starts with the swing, exactly as you said, the two-hand swing, the one-hand swing, learn to switch hands. You know, then from there, you got to look at the squat. The kettlebell is a great tool for the squat, specifically the goblet squat, where you hold it for, you know, with two arms in front of your body, your elbows resting against your torso, your palms are open, you're grabbing it by the, exactly, grabbing it by the ball. I like it with the handle facing down and grabbing it by the ball, but, you know, some people like to hold it by the handle. In either case, you hold it in front of you and you squat down. You got that offset, so the weight's in front of you. That gives you the comfort to sit back and down, working the hips, working the knees, full range of motion.
That's a bit like a front squat, really, isn't it?
It's like a front squat, yes, but it's a front squat, rather a goblet squat. So if someone is familiar with front squat with a bar, the difference is going to be that with the kettlebell, we keep our arm in a vertical position, elbows against the torso, whereas with a bar, the elbows are out in front like that. And that's not conducive to shoulder, wrist, and finger health for a lot of people. So the kettlebell takes out that layer of complexity, makes it much easier to access. You just pick it up, you hold it against, and you sit down. So it is a type of front squat, but I was specifying a goblet squat.
Okay, got you. So we've got the swings. We've learned to goblet squat.
Yep.
Where would we move to from there?
Now I like to go straight overhead. I like to go straight overhead for a press. And, you know, in the full kettlebell, well, we got to come to our chest before we go overhead, right? So it's sitting on the ground. So I got to get it off the ground. Well, that's the swing. If you break the swing down further, it's a deadlift before it's a swing. But I don't start by teaching you a deadlift because a kettlebell deadlift is not a deadlift. You know, a deadlift, the weight is not sufficient in that sense. So, you know, if someone wanted to break it down very mechanically, they could say before the swing is a deadlift. In that sense, it's true because you got a deadlift, you got to lift a dead weight off the ground, but it's a deadlift that immediately falls back into a swing. So we're just going to say swing, understanding that there's a deadlift inside the swing. Okay. Now from there, normally we bring it to the chest. Now that we get it off the ground, we get it moving and keep it moving. That's the swing. And now we vertically accelerate it upward and we catch it at the chest. That's a clean. Now that we have the clean, we can go overhead with it with a press. However, I'm not saying to learn the clean because I'm talking to a beginner that's just starting. And they're going to learn how, and we're talking low barriers of entry. You can learn this on your first day. Okay. You don't need specialized practice. The clean, it's technical. You're going to bang your wrist 50, 100 times until you finally learn to slide your hand. And, you know, so it's not even necessary if you don't care about kettlebells. You just want the physical benefits. You need the swing, you squat, and you need to hold it overhead. So in that case, right after swing, you're going to go to the press and you're going to do that putting it on the floor, inserting one hand all the way inside, using the second hand, so you're squatting down, using the second hand to help assist it lift it up to the chest. And now your hand's in the correct position, and now you press it overhead. Later, if you, you know, now you're training with me multiple times, maybe on the third, fourth, you know, or if you learn fast, maybe on the second. Now I'm going to show you the clean. You know, the clean's more detailed though. That's now you're getting into the specialization of the kettlebell technique. That's a different objective than I'm a triathlon, you know, athlete, and I using the kettlebell. I don't really necessarily. I'm not ready to work out the, you know, the perfection of the clean technique. That's going to take a while. So we're going just swing, goblet squat, overhead press. In the overhead position, you're going to work the fixation. Your elbow is fully locked out. The kettlebell is vertically aligned over your base of support, which is your feet. And in order to assure that, you want your bicep next to your ear. So when you're standing up, you want your bicep next to your ear so there's no gap. You don't want the arm drifting away, because now as that arm drifts away, the load is outside of your base, which means you're struggling and straining to hold it. So you want that arm next to the head so that kettlebell is sitting. That's your posture. That's your postural alignment to where the bones of your body and your postural muscles of your back, your prime movers, your posterior chain is doing the work to hold it. And that's what we want to learn. Also in cycling, because it's your postural integrity. You're not breaking under the load. Your posture is what's holding you there.
What I like about you, you just mentioned postural alignment, Steve, and that's again very perceptive of you. And that whole thing about the posture and the running posture, and it, once you can keep your torso erect and your posture in the right alignment, that also enhances breathing, which is, you know, if you not doing that effectively towards the end of the race. But you mentioned posterior chain there, and all of the actions that happen in triathlon are anterior chain. Everything that athletes are doing is happening in front of the body, and life is forcing us into the movements. You know, you think when you're sitting, we're tightening up around the hip flexors, we're at our computers, we're driving, we're eating, everything's happening, we're getting tight pectorals. We forget about the muscles of the posterior chain. So, and that's one of the other things that I've come to appreciate about kettlebells is a lot of the work that you're doing there when you are talking about squatting, when you're talking about swings, when you're talking about the press, is it's that postural chain work. The other thing that, you know, we talk about the primal patterns. So you haven't mentioned those, Steve, but push, pull, squat, hinge, rotate, and lunge. So when you do a kettlebell swing, you're going to do that first deadlift, but then you're going to be hinging all the time. You talk about squatting. A kettlebell is effectively a pull as well. A swing is effectively a pull. The press is effectively a push. There will be no doubt some exercises that you are going to mention in a moment that where we can involve more rotational work. And of course, we can bring in some more complex movements that involve lunging, whether we do that with a kettlebell or not. So in three or four exercises there, we can hit all of the primal movement patterns, which is about as much as we need to ask out of a strength program.
Yes. Yes. So locomotion, really, when you talk about rotation, yes. I call it locomotion. So there's different ways to sort of describe the primal movement patterns, but that's body weight. You know, locomotion is the movement. And there's other things, you know, rolling a rope is incredible for locomotion. It's WEC method is, you know, people usually jump a rope with a jump rope, you know, usually jump a rope, but you learn to roll the rope without jumping. Now you got the figure eight. Now you got the figure eights and the interaction of the, you know, literally the X of the body. It's the corset. You know, it's upper and lower body work in oppositions. There's push, there's pull, there's forward, there's back, there's right, there's left, there's long side, short side. So, you know, that is the rotation. That is locomotion. And the best way to train that is the body weight. So going back to what I said at the beginning, you know, your body weight is foundational. Whatever else tool you add to that, you know, we've been talking about the kettlebell, and I would say the kettlebell, the body weight together is working the full holistic approach. In particular for a triathlete, you know, a bench press isn't important for performance. So, you know, if someone is in strength training, you can say, well, the kettlebell doesn't have, you know, any heavy horizontal component or few horizontal components, you know, in general. There's a lot of vertical. So we're hitting the vertical pushing movements. We're hitting the vertical pulling movements. We're hitting the hinging of the hips, the hinging of the knees. There's a lot of core stability, you know, especially when you have it overhead and you're doing things like, say, a windmill, an overhead squat, a get up where you have to stabilize your midline, you know, so you're getting that. You're not getting a lot of rotation in the classical movement. So that's where we have our body weight. We introduce that figure eight patterns and lunging patterns and so on, you know. And so now what about the horizontal? Well, there's horizontal pushing, there's horizontal pulling. So kettlebell classically is not addressing a lot of horizontal. Now you can be creative, you can be inventive, and you can plug that in. However, every tool has best uses. There's no tool that has all uses. So as great as a kettlebell is, if you feel you need to get some more horizontal strength training and some horizontal pulling, some horizontal pushing, well, body weight is great there. Suspension training has some great applications there. Barbell has some great applications there. So as great as it is, I don't think it's all things for all causes. What I will say is, as a cross-training tool, you're going to get more bang for your buck and more readily transferable quality developments that's going to help a triathlete better than any other single tool that I can think of as far as a strength training implement.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we talk about the strength training implement, Steve, but we can't ignore those other positive elements that we talked about before: portability, time effectiveness, you know, and they're crucial for people in the modern era, aren't they? You know, yeah. Lives.
There's nothing to it but to do it, as the saying goes. And all the best training methods and theories that we come across are only as good as those which we actually do. And that's what it comes down to. So it's, what am I going to do? And with the kettlebell, we are telling them, and this is the truth, we are removing the barriers to entry. You're a busy person. You got a training schedule. You're not going to deviate from that. Let's just be clear. So you're going to add something. What can you afford to add? We're not asking a lot of you. We're saying you give 10, 15 minutes and you give 3 days, kettlebells is going to cover you. And that's the truth. Because we're not wasting time with the kettlebell. It's, you're on and it's boom and you're out and you worked everything. You don't have to go to the gym. You don't have to go anywhere. It's right here, right now. You know, so it doesn't get any easier. And if you're not going to do that, you're not going to do anything. So, and that's fine too.
When you talk about that 10 to 15 minutes, Steve, would you break that down in the way that we would traditionally have done if we were following a bodybuilding routine where we're doing four sets of 10 reps with a short rest? Or do you find a workout that incorporates a duration or a set number of swings, moving into single-handed swings, moving into getting the kettlebell up to the chest and holding it in a goblet squat, doing 10 squats, then back into some swings, then doing some presses? Do you just keep moving for the entire 10 minutes or do you take a break?
Yeah, there's going to be two main ways that you're going to break that down, which I'll explain. But at the end of it, especially in the context that we're suggesting, you're not looking for rest with the kettlebell. You're doing it for a short period of time. You want to work and you want to maximize that time. So that work period, if it's 10 or 15 minutes in this case, you're working for the whole time. Does that mean you can't put it down and take a 15 or 30 second interval? Yes, you can. So that you can interval training. That's going to be one, which is, you know, the example, if it's four sets of 10 or it's, you know, I'm going to work 30 seconds, rest 30 seconds, and, you know, as all out for 30, and now I'm going to recover for 30, and I'm going to keep repeating that, and I can vary exercises or I can do the same exercise for multiple, and I'm going to repeat that. I'm going to do that for 10 minutes. That's one approach. Another approach is time. So you have the interval, which is usually going to be sets and reps, or you have the time, which is, I'm going to work for 10 minutes, and I'm not going to put this kettlebell down. And I can switch hands anytime I want, and I can switch exercise anytime I want, but I'm working for time, you know, and that's the, and in general, how you're progressing it is volume. So there's three variables. There's the load of the kettlebell. How heavy is the kettlebell? There's the time. And we can say reps, but in this sense, reps and time are the same, because the longer you work, the more reps you're going to accumulate. So you have the weight of the kettlebell, the time of the training session, and then you have the speed of the lift, which is, we measure speed in rate per unit of time, or more detailed is repetition per minute. So those are the three variables that we're going to play with. And there's nothing magical. Any training program is going to be based on an overload principle. So if it's a progressive overload, and let's say it's 8-week program, let's say it's 12-week program, whatever the time period, you want to see that over time, the volume increases. That's how we get stronger. That's how we get in better condition, is we have to be able to do more, right? So you have to be measuring those things if we want to know, like we have to quantify some data. That's your journal. So you did this many reps. It took you this long, and you used that weight. And that's the volume of work that you did. You can calculate a metric ton of how much work you did. And, you know, so that number should keep going up over time. How that goes up, well, there's different ways to do it. You can increase the weight of the kettlebell and do the same number of reps. You know, you can keep the kettlebell but do more reps. You can do the same kettlebell, same reps, but do it in less time. You know,
it doesn't really matter then.
Which method you choose? No, it doesn't matter for our purposes here, because it's not the main activity. We're not talking about, you're an athlete and your sport is kettlebell sport, because now you have to have a periodization. We're talking about, you're an athlete from triathlon and you're looking to cross train to support that. You don't actually care if I tell you, hey, this apple, you lift this apple overhead and that's going to make you perform better in triathlon. Well, you'll probably give that a try. So it's not about the kettlebell. It's about the amount of work that you can accomplish per unit of time. The kettlebell is going to give you that volume. You're going to get more volume per unit of time with a kettlebell than you can get with a dumbbell or than you can get with a barbell. And that's what it comes down to. So, you know, because it's weight times reps divided by time. That's your power output. And you're not going to spend an hour in the gym. You're not going to drive 30 minutes each way. So now it's 2 hours, because that 2 hours you're going to be using on your bike or running or swimming, right?
Yeah.
Or with your family on Sunday or whatever, right? So let's be realistic about what is accessible. You can do the kettlebell where you are right now, because you just need to buy one kettlebell and you go and you watch Steve Cotter videos and you're solid on the basics. You know, and you love it so much. Now you reach out, you send Steve an email and, hey, I'm going to come out to San Diego to train with you. Or, hey, do you know anyone that's good in my neck of the woods that you can recommend, because I want to train with someone, you know, and we take it further. But just as far as entry, it's not that complicated. You can just enter real simple, you know, and it's, again, we're keeping it real realistic. Let's say 10, 15 minutes. Can I accomplish something? You can accomplish something in that time. You can accomplish a lot to where it's going to make a fundamental difference in your, especially physical stamina, your muscular endurance, because the cardio endurance is already going to be very high with a triathlete. And it might, you know, probably will help in that area as well. You know, but the bigger benefit is going to be on the muscular stamina, endurance, and resiliency to not break down under the high volume that you're doing in your main movements of, you know, the human movement patterns of triathlon.
So when I'm thinking about this now, Steve, it would be fairly easy to accomplish a 10-minute workout that you could do, incorporating just those three exercises we talked about: the swing,
yes,
the goblet squat, and the press. And you could, you know, I mean, we know that the body becomes more efficient through adaptation. So if we want to confuse it a little bit, we can change the order we do those. We could learn how to do the single-handed swings. So we just stress the body in a slightly different way. We could learn that little bit of skill where we catch the bell in midair and swap hands. We can do different types of press. I mean, I guess what you could do is once you've got the goblet squat, you could continue to press the bar straight up. So you're doing like a
thrust. You can start making compounds out of the movements.
Yeah, exactly. and you can keep changing all of those around.
It goes back to the three points of the load, the time, and the speed. It goes to the load, the number of repetition or duration, and the speed, of which is how many repetitions you get in that unit of time, right? And so as long as you're recording it, you know, okay, I'm going to do 5 sets of 20. No, I'm going to do 10 sets of 10. No, I'm going to do 4 sets of 25. Okay, it's all good. At the end of it, make sure that your volume's going up, because that's the best indication that you're getting in more shape, because you can handle more workload. And the other important thing, which a lot of times people don't talk about, is how you feel. You don't want to get beat up by the training. You want the training to feel like, yes, I got some good work, and now I'm going to eat and take a nap, and now you're performing better in your activity. You're not beating yourself up in the gym or in your, you know, cross-training workout to where it has a negative effect, to where it's like, man, I'm so tired. That's not the goal. The goal is that you want it to add to your life. You want it to...
Yeah, because I think that's one of the myths about that people have about going to the gym, is that if you're not feeling sore the next day, you're not really working hard enough. But of course, if you're feeling sore and your quads are sore or your shoulders are tight, you're not going to be able to swim or run as effectively. And as you've already mentioned quite correctly, this is supposed to be complementing our swim, bike, and run performance. It's not supposed to be replacing it. It's supposed to be helping us to be better triathletes so that we can swim, bike, and run. And be more resilient at doing that. So
exactly. You're going to be a better triathlete because you're going to be a better athlete, because you're going to be a stronger athlete. You're going to have a more physically resilient skeletal structure because of the fact that you're doing resistance training in a cyclical fashion. It's different than the conventional weight training. It's not cyclical. The kettlebells is, and the tool is designed to facilitate the cyclical movement much more efficiently than what you can do with a dumbbell, certainly much more than what you can do with a barbell. So just the design itself facilitates that. And so that's the overlap there, and that's the complement. And probably in the triathlete world, the real legends and the real champs of those, you know, the other athletes are like, they're stronger athletes. That's why they're stronger athletes, you know, because everybody's putting in a ton of mileage, you know. So there's probably amateurs that are putting in the same or, you know, mileage as professionals. So what is the distinction? I think ultimately everything is mental strength, because that drives, you know, but that the training also and the strength. The kettlebell can make someone that is not as strong, will make them stronger in a way that they're not going to get from, you know, traditional bodybuilding movements.
You mentioned that strength there, Steve. I think that's the important thing for me. And it's not just about what happens in the competition. It's about the resiliency to be able to absorb that training over many months. We both know that what's helped the best athletes to get to the position they're in is the consistency of training, not just over a few weeks, but over many months. The ones who get injured the less tend to keep making progress. They're not playing snakes and ladders where they're going up a bit and then coming back down. They just keep that slow ascent every year. And you often hear elite athletes in all sorts of sports when they ask, when the commentators ask, well, how come you're so good this year? He said, well, I had a really solid winter of training. You know, I wasn't in no interruptions. And that comes from creating the foundation. You know, the things we mentioned right at the beginning, the foundation of sleep, of nutrition, of restfulness. And then on top of that, the foundation of strength and resiliency. And then on top of that is where we put the sport-specific training. But you know, the height of the pyramid is only as high as the width of the base. To go back to your ancient civilizations, is the wider the base, the higher the peak. And what we're trying to do here is create a solid, wide base. And kettlebell's not the only thing, but for me, and I really like the way you've sort of reinforced this point today. It complements that to enable you to do the other stuff to build a bigger peak.
Yes, yeah, that's really well said, and we agree on those points certainly.
Do you think that might be a good place to stop then?
Yeah, we definitely covered a lot of ground. We're both, you know, big proponents of the kettlebell. It's a great complement for a triathlete and a busy, you know, a busy person, a busy professional, a busy athlete that is looking to improve performance. And so if they go to the gym or if they're thinking about going to the gym, it's because you're really dedicated to improving and you know you need to do some cross training. So we really want to just help you have an opportunity to get involved with it easily. You know, a kettlebell is really very accessible. And that's really the most important point. And, you know, the efficiency of it is going to speak for itself. You're not going to come across someone who swings a kettlebell and is like, oh, that doesn't work. You know what I mean? It's dynamic. And as long as you get some good coaching at the beginning and learn how to do it correctly so you don't injure yourself, you know, it could be a huge game changer for all your listeners, like it has been for you.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate you coming on today. Thank you. It's Sunday morning for you, so and I know we've taken a bit of time to get this together, so appreciate you taking that time. Thanks for sharing those insights, not just into training with kettlebells, but also into your insights about life. I read a book by Tim Ferriss called Tools of Titans, and in there he refers to a lot of the moguls and behemoths from certain industries and sports and the military. And nearly all of those high performers seem to have traits and habits that they follow every day: meditation, gratitude, some form of workout, some understanding of life on a deeper meaning. So, and you've echoed a lot of those. So that was really interesting as well. You've mentioned quite a few links there that I've got. We talked about Omvana, the six-phase meditation. I like that, and Mind Valley. You talk about Wim Hof and his books. I'm going to reference some of those. You talked about the four. Was it 1421, the book you were reading at the moment? Was that the
title? Yeah, I'm actually reading several. 1421 is one of them. I'm also reading, you know, mythology and human, you know, the myth literature and in human civilizations, the histories of myths. And yeah, but 1421 is an interesting one for historians. You know, it's about ships and sailing, Chinese sailors, you know, doing it before the Europeans got involved and took all the credit, you know, of naming everything. But
okay,
it's just what it is. You know, it's
I'll find out where people can get hold of that book if they're interested. I will definitely make some references. I'll go through your kettlebell links on your YouTube channel and reference those exercises we talked about, just the basic ones, and let people get going on those. And I think that's about it, really. There's an awful lot of links to be going on with. I'm so grateful to you for spending this time with us today, Steve. And
super pleasure.
Yeah, hopefully we'll meet up inside another 9 years, and maybe we'll see if we can we can get a workshop together in the UK for all these eager triathletes.
That would be a great idea. And I would love to come back to UK and provide some training there. That would be a fantastic offer. Love to see triathletes swinging the bells. I think that could be really quite innovative.
Well, you know, Steve, San Diego was where they think that triathlon started way back in the 70s, but Leeds now has one of the best performance centers in the world. We have the reigning double Olympic champion and his brother both live here. We've got the reigning, I think she was the runner-up, second and third females in the world championship this year. Last time we had the Olympics in 2016, five of the six triathlon team members were from based in Leeds, so we now have a rightful claim to be the triathlon center of the world. So be only That's fitting great. That you bring yourself from San Diego to Leeds and show us how to use kettlebells.
There's a connection. You guys have surfing out there, probably not, huh?
Not in Leeds. No, we're a little way from the sea here in Leeds, but yeah, there's places you can get to fairly easy where there's some surfing, but it's not like it is in California. I mean, it definitely would. You'd need to wear a dry suit most of the year.
Yeah. San Diego's got a lot of different activities. I had forgotten it's also considered a triathlon capital. Yeah. But yeah, sounds like you guys are taking the mantle.
Steve, thanks once again. Happy 2020, and we'll catch up soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Simon. Happy 2020 to you.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.